Well, you can't sue God if you can't serve the papers on him, according to a Nebraska District Court judge. Judge Marlon Polk threw out a Nebraska Senator Ernie Chambers lawsuit against the Almighty, saying that there was no evidence that the defendant had been served. What's more, the judge found that there can never be service put on the name of the defendant. Chambers had sued God in September of 2007, seeking a permanent injunction to prevent God from committing acts of violence, such as earthquakes and tornadoes. The senator said today that he's considering an appeal. I don't know. You know, using science to conclude that nothing happens by chance and that some kind of organizing and guiding process must exist, including examples of prophetic dreams and other anomalous occurrences. The great work of Dr. Gary Schwartz, the G.O.D. experiments, that's next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Gary Schwartz, Ph.D., professor of psychology, medicine, neurology, psychiatry, and surgery at the University of Arizona, director of its Human Energy Systems Laboratory. After receiving his doctorate from Harvard, he served as a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Yale University and a director of the Yale Psychophilosophy Center and co-director of the Yale Behavioral Medicine Clinic. Here he is on Coast to Coast, Gary Schwartz. Hey, Gary, how are you?
Very good, thanks. How are you?
Good. It's good to have you back on the program. Lots been going on. My gosh.
Yeah. In the world and in both of our lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The G-O-D experiments. Should I say the God experiments, or is there a reason for the periods there?
The reason for the periods is because the word G-O-D actually is an acronym for a guiding, organizing, designing process, which is what, as a scientist, I came to think about as something I think that's in common to many people's ideas of a God or an Allah or a great spirit or an infinite intelligence or the source. You know, different people have different words for these concepts, but they all involve some sort of guidance, some sort of organization, and some sort of designing process.
The work that you've done on this one, you know, you've looked at afterlife experiments, and you know, you've devoted your career to this, to energy healing, consciousness. What are you starting to conclude, Gary, about what's out there?
Well, you know, it's when I look at the totality of all these different areas, and in particular with the G.O.D. experiments, one is sort of forced to come to the conclusion that there's some sort of fundamental, universal, and potentially infinite, if you would, consciousness and intelligence, which is sort of like a hologram, and that is it's present everywhere in everything. In fact, I use the metaphor in the book, so to speak, the all is in the small. In fact, the word small actually has the word all in it. And that this intelligence, this consciousness, this capacity to organize and if you would quote, make alive, is part of everything, including us. And what's sort of unique about human beings, at least as far as we know, is that we have a greater capacity to both envision, potentially communicate with, and manifest this potential than any other creature that we know.
You know, I've always said, Gary, that there are no coincidences, that things happen for a reason, whether fate does things or this cosmic energy that we're going to be talking about tonight. Mm-hmm. Some would call it God, but I just don't believe in coincidences. And I think you're saying the same thing when you're saying nothing happens by chance, aren't you?
Yes. In fact, what's actually amusing, and we'll probably hopefully have a chance to talk about this later, is that buried in the back of the book, Appendix C, was a chapter called Synchronicity in New York City, which tells an extraordinary real-life event that happened to me but was part of my transformation to this conclusion. And when I originally wrote the chapter, it was going to be included in the main part of the book, and both my editor and my writing partner felt that you know, it's too coincidental to be accidental, that kind of information. Both of those people felt that this was too far out for many readers to be able to understand, and they didn't want to include it at all. And I said I couldn't publish this book without at least honoring the fact that this is a real phenomena and that it needed to be included in the book. So we actually put it in Appendix C. And what's amusing is your belief system and your, I'm sure, your own personal experience.
Yes.
It's the actual start of our conversation. So it's very delightful to know that we'll eventually get there.
Yeah, I think so, too. You know, science may never find out. Science may never admit or give us the answers. But I think we'll find it in our own ways, don't you think?
Absolutely. The only thing that I would qualify that statement is I think that for us to find it in our own ways, we actually become the scientists, meaning we become self-explorers. And through a process of discovery, we learn what's real and what's not real. So we're actually practicing, if you would, the art and the essence of science. It's just we're not doing it in the laboratory. We're doing it in the laboratory of our own lives.
We are doing it in the laboratory of our own lives, and everybody's starting to do it more and more, Gary. I think there's more of an awareness these days.
Absolutely.
Maybe stress? I don't know. What creates that?
Well, you know, when we face ever greater challenges, when we ponder, for example, the possible demise of the whole planet, and it encourages us to think about and return to basic questions of who are we, why are we here, you know, what is our potential, is there a purpose, is there a higher purpose, so on and so forth. And the other thing is that we have more freedom now to think about those kinds of things than people in earlier eras did. I mean, the truth is we have all of these conveniences, and we have much greater wealth and opportunity than existed in previous times in history. And so more of us have the opportunity to actually reflect upon these things. And, of course, your show in particular encourages people on a nightly basis to ask the big questions.
And these topics, we are really starting to push the envelope, Gary, because I just think it's so important that now that people within themselves get some answers for themselves. How they do it, what they come up with, you know what, that's their own business.
Mm-hmm.
But, that's why programs such as this with you are just so important. Have you always been a believer in the higher intelligence?
Absolutely not. I was brought up in a family that was a-religious. It wasn't irreligious. It was just a-religious. It was not part of the, my upbringing. Even though I was brought up in a virtually all Christian community, I mean, my parents were Reformed Jews. But what I affectionately like to say, and was actually pointed out to me by my part of it, is that I was actually raised to be an Orthodox agnostic, which may sound a little funny. And what's meant by that is that I was raised to ask questions. So if the question was, it didn't matter what the question was, is there gravity or is there God? It didn't matter. My response was, I don't know, could be yes, could be no, show me the data, I'm open. So what happened was that I was just raised to not know, to be a questioner, to be, so to speak, a seeker. And it really wasn't until my time at Yale as a professor that I stumbled upon a series of things both in science and in my personal life that then pushed me on this journey, which ultimately led to that book and beyond.
Was it a difficult switch for you?
Yes. And some of it was extraordinarily difficult because I had to deal with both ideas, conclusions, and also phenomena that was, almost considered heresy by my academic, professional peers, as well as my own upbringing. So, yeah, there were times that it was just, I was real soul-searching, if you would, existential crisis, addressing a paradigm that was beyond anything I was, led to be open to.
Is it safe to assume that pure evil does not believe in a higher intelligence, higher consciousness, God, call it what you will.
Wow, that is a really, I've never heard that question before. The answer, of course, is I don't know. I mean, that's,
see, I don't think they do. I think, and I've watched an evolution now, Gary, of people, that as they become closer to what you have in this book, the GOD experiments, they become better people. They become more enlightened. And the people that I have seen now and witnessed in my life who are what I call pure evil, some of them we see on the news, okay? So, and I don't know them personally, but you know that they're just not good people.
Right.
I don't think they believe in a higher intelligence. I don't think they care. For some reason, people who believe tend to be better people, nicer people. They care about people.
You know, I'm going to call that the George Norrie hypothesis.
That's your next book.
George Norrie hypothesis. But I want you to know, first of all, that is consistent with my overall personal experience. Okay, that's number one. Number two, it's a very beautiful hypothesis, because if it turned out that there was really a correspondence with people's kindness and caring and compassion and humility and openness and so on, and if you would, universal love, that all of that grows in direct proportion to one's awareness of connection and connection to this this higher intelligence, higher power, and so on. That would be a profound positive, consequence for both the belief and the and its effects. By the way, you know, I don't know if you saw a sort of a silly movie called Evan Almighty.
Oh yeah, sure did.
You sure did. Well, as you know, the theme of that is our acts of random kindness, which is ARC, and of course, Evan Almighty was about Noah. And when I heard your introductory bit of humor, I guess it was sort of humor,
about
this guy who was suing God, I was reminded at the tail end of the Evan Almighty, Morgan Freeman, who plays God, is being questioned by who was it that played Evan Baxter?
It was Jim Carrey, wasn't it?
No, I think it was Steve Carell. Jim
Carell.
Carrey was in Carrell. Bruce
Yes.
Almighty.
Yes.
And Steve Carell said, did you play a role in helping to keep us from ending up leading and directing us and guiding us to where we ended up going in the ark? And he said, well, he said, maybe I shoved you a little. And he said, if you don't like it, sue me.
Well, it got tossed out of court.
So I got it.
You talk a little bit about England's dream detective, Christopher Robinson.
Yes.
Tell me about that relationship.
Sure. By the way, that particular story was an actual research experiment, was one of the first times that actually in scientific research I was pushed to the conclusion that there was some sort of a guiding, organizing, designing process, some sort of higher power, excuse me, literally playing a role in our research. And here's the beginning part, and you can ask me questions as we go along.
Sure.
I received a phone call from a man, and this was, I think it was in April of 2001, from England, claiming to be England's dream detective, his name's Christopher Robinson, claiming that he had been having precognitive dreams for a good 15 years after he had a near-death experience and almost died, that these dreams were sufficiently accurate that he was able to predict, for example, terrorist activity in his dreams, that he'd been secretly working for Scotland Yard and British intelligence for some time, that he was sensing that there were worse things going to be happening, and that he felt it was really, and that people weren't taking him seriously, and that he wanted to be tested, and that he was willing to fly to America on his own money to do an experiment that he would try to prove to an open-minded scientist that what he could do was real. Now, of course, I had no idea whether this guy was a fruitcake or whether he was a whether he had a genuine gift, mm-hmm. At least when I first started speaking with him. And after a few conversations, I began to realize that he was serious, and I asked him what kind of experiment would he like to do, and I helped him design what up to that point was the most bizarre experiment that I had ever conducted. And here's what he proposed that we do.
Okay.
He was going to ask me to pick 10 different locations in greater southern Arizona that varied, you know, like telescopes at the top of Kitt Peak. Of course, he didn't know which ones of sites I would pick, an Air and Space Museum, or downtown Tucson, or, you know, different sites that I had some emotional attachment to.
Right.
And what I actually did was pick 20 of them. The reason I picked 20 as opposed to 10 is because he wanted to go to go to 10 different sites. But I figured if there were actually 20 possible sites, that even at the 10th site, I still wouldn't know where we were going, because there would be 11 possibilities remaining. So anyway, I was to pick these 10 sites. I was supposed to tell no one about what they were. I was going to then put them in envelopes and seal the envelopes. And by the way, I was going to do this at the end of July, and he was going to come out in August. So I did that in July, the end of July. I created these 20 envelopes, videotaped them so that it was a record of it. I then mailed those sealed envelopes to my writing partner, who lives in California. He then gave them to a third person so that I was not, you know, privy to knowing who this person was, because he wanted to make sure there was no possibility of fraud here. The envelopes were then shuffled by that third person. Of course, they were sealed. And they were numbered 1 to 20, okay? And numbers 1 to 10 were going to be the 10 sites that we end up going to, one envelope per day. And then the other 10 would be controls. You with me so far?
Yes.
Okay. Then what was happening is he was going to come out to Tucson, and after he got settled, he would go to sleep at night and ask the universe where was he going to be taken the next day. He would then dream during the night. He would write down his dreams. I would then meet with him the next morning, and he would then show me what he had written down, review the dreams. He would then give me the highlights, the themes, the key words that supposedly would happen during the day, and most hopefully during to either going to the site or at the site. After all that was recorded, then and only then would I call my writing partner, who would then contact the third person, who would then open the envelope, and I would then be called back, and we'd be told where we were going. At that point, I would not tell Christopher where we were going. Of course, I didn't tell my writing partner what the dream information was. And then with our video cameras, we would then go en route and go to the site and see which pieces of information showed up and which didn't, okay? At the end of that period of time, we'd come back to his hotel. We would review what pieces fit and what pieces didn't fit, and that would finish the day.
Let's let you finish when we come right back. Do a little review and then onward with this experiment that you had with England's dream detective, Christopher Robinson. Gary, go ahead.
Sure. So here we were. He's about to wants to do this experiment where for 10 consecutive days he's going to come to Tucson and dream where we're going to go on the next day and where they're going to then figure out what percent accurate he is. Now,
and does he have to be accurate for the day, or, you know, if on day one happened to have been envelope 8, that you open up 8 days later, let's say, would you count that as a hit?
No, it's got to be for the envelope for that day.
Okay.
And he said that he couldn't narrow it down to the few hours of the actual event. So he said some of it might spill over to after the event, and I'll give you an example in a second. But here's what was totally weird. We're discussing this in April, planning for an experiment to start in August. And then he tells me, he said, Gary, he said, I'm going to start dreaming in May. And I said, excuse me? He says, yeah, in May what I'm going to do for 10 consecutive nights, I'm going to dream where you're going to be taking me 3 months from now. I said, Christopher, I have not picked the places yet. He said, it doesn't matter. I said to him, Christopher, I can't handle that. I said, you're the dream detective. You know that you want to decide. I'd like to collect lots of data. I said, well, if you want to collect the data, fine. Don't tell me about it. So what happens is for May, he dreams 10 consecutive nights. In June, he dreams 10 consecutive nights. And then in July, he dreams 10 consecutive nights. So he comes to Tucson already with 30 dreams. And I was not actually prepared to handle that, okay? And then we start the normal 10-day experiment. So he's going to use the actual night before he dreams plus the other three nights that he had dreamt, one in each consecutive month.
Okay.
So what did we find overall? And then let me give you an example of a particular day which speaks to the idea of some sort of guiding, organizing, designing process in this research. First of all, when you looked at the overall accuracy, he was 10 out of 10.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. But that doesn't mean anything until I give you an example of the data. So let me give you day 5, because day 5 was a turning point day for me. Remember, he had already had 4 successful days. So here's day 5. I go to the hotel, and he tells me the following. He says, we're going to be going someplace to, he says, I'm seeing a border, something with a border. And he said, policemen, and they're going to be holding up traffic. He says, I see a car. He said, I see boats, lots of boats. He said, and I then see a car. The car has a flat tire, and it reminds me of something related to the London Embassy. He said, I see you needing a, and he said, the car has no, quote, mineral oil, which, of course, made no sense to me. Then he said, I see that you need some sort of a card, a credit card, to get into a store or something. He said, I see a row of tires along a chain-link fence. He said, I see lots of umbrellas, and I see the Spirit of God. That was his list. Now, in my head, I'm saying, okay, what could that possibly, of the 16 remaining sites, what could that possibly be? And there was only one site that I thought would fit, which was, because one of the sites was, possible sites, was to go to what's called Nogales, which is a town in Mexico, on the border of Arizona and Mexico. Because mm-hmm. then you'd have to go through a border, there'd be police and holding things up, there are cars with flat tires, you know, they have lots of boats there because people trailer boats, you know, there are tires on chain link fences, they have umbrellas. So I thought that might fit. So anyway, he gives me all the information, I then call my writing partner, opens the envelope, and he then calls me back, and he says, we're going to the gem and mineral store in South Tucson. Now, at this point, I was actually relieved, because I was convinced that Christopher finally got something wrong, okay? But I didn't tell him
he's
that.
He's human, right?
He's human, okay? So we pack up our gear, and we start traveling to this gem and mineral store. By the way, I would normally go to this gem and mineral store. And as we're going along, Christopher says to me, he says, are we near the border? I said, no. He said, are you sure? I said, yes, Christopher. Trust me, it's 40 miles away. He said, my dream was very clear. There was something to do with policemen and border. I said, trust me, Christopher, we're not at the border. We drive along 2 minutes later, and Christopher says, look, there's a policeman holding up traffic. And sure enough, there was. However, there are lots of policemen holding up traffic, right?
Right, exactly.
Of course. But nonetheless, we drive down that street. And where they're doing the construction, there is a water tower. And the water tower says Borderland. The name of the company was Borderland. So I said, that's interesting. We drive a little bit further, and a person trailering a boat passes us. We then pass a boat storage yard. We then make a right turn onto the street going to the gem and mineral store. And there are two racks, each rack containing 4 boats. Now, remember, we're in the desert. That's a lot of boats. So I said, Well, we get to the gem and mineral store. And sitting in front of the store, which, of course, I had not paid attention to this thing. I'd only been there a couple of times. Turns out to be a car with 4 flat tires. Now, when I saw that car, you know, I was totally shocked. Christopher, of course, was thrilled because in his dream, he told me, he could walk right up and touch the tire. So, of course, we took video of all of this, and I took the image.
Yeah.
You know what kind of car it was? It was a Rambler Ambassador. And he said, car related to London Embassy. And it's an ambassador. The car had no oil, and it was in front of a mineral store, gem and mineral store. He said it had no mineral oil. I went into this store to ask them. I said, well, how long has that car been sitting in front of your store? He said, oh, about 20 years.
20 years?
20 years. In fact, it was even in a movie. Anyway, however, there were no, I didn't need a credit card to get into the store. There were no tires on a chain link fence. There were no umbrellas. There was nothing with the Spirit of God. But he got a lot right, right? So we went back to the hotel. We listed the things that fit. We listed the things that didn't fit. Now the experiment is officially over for the day. Now this is when it gets weird. I then said to Christopher, look, I'm running out of digital videotape. And it turned out Christopher was getting low, too. I said, on the way to the lab, I said, would you mind if I stopped at a store that has a lot of videotapes at low cost? He said, sure. So I took him to Costco. Now, Costco, as you probably know, is a chain where in order to get in, you have to be a member, and you have to show them a credit card.
Yeah, it's Sam's Club.
You like Sam's Club. Right? And when I did that, Christopher said, oh, look, my dream said you were going to be needing a credit card to get into a store. Now, when he reminded me of this, I said, oh, that was just probably because he made an unconscious suggestion to me, and that's why I picked this store. So I didn't think anything of it. Well, we look around for the videotapes. Then I had to get back to the lab, and Christopher says, I'm hungry. And I said, Christopher, I appreciate that, but I've got to now get to the lab. He says, but I'm hungry. So I said, look, the only place we could eat is if we buy something here at Costco, and, you know, in their sort of fast food area. He said, fine. So I bought him a chicken sandwich. We sit down. And then we sit down, and he says, Gary, look over there. And what are we sitting next to? A chain link fence with tires, just as he had drawn it in his dream. And then he says, and look, Gary, look around. And I look around, and there were maybe 20 tables there, picnic tables, round picnic tables. Each of them has an umbrella in the center. Now, this is, you know, in the indoors, but they had these big umbrellas. So now I'm looking at all these umbrellas. And then I noticed that they have writing on these umbrellas. Now, this is the part that got really weird, and I will never forget this. It turned out that the umbrellas had advertisements for Hebrew National hot dogs. And their slogan on all these umbrellas was, we answer to a higher authority. Ergo, the Spirit of God.
Yeah.
Now, how could he in his dreams collected over 3 months and integrated, how could he have not only known that we'd be going to a gem and mineral store, which he never said gem and mineral store, but he got all the details correct. But not only that, would then know that we would then go into a store where not only would the details of the card and the tires and the umbrellas fit, but there'd be a direct reference to the Spirit of the God, and we answer to a higher authority. That was the day that I started thinking about that there was even more going on in this experiment that I was prepared to see. Now, Christopher confessed to me that he had been feeling that he was getting this information not just, for example, from deceased policemen or people who had been murdered, that would be coming to him in his dreams. But he also felt that somehow he was getting this information from, quote, the source or a higher power. And he felt that there was tremendous intelligence with the information. And slowly but surely, as I describe in the book, I was led to the conclusion that the way in which he received this information, the detail about that information, the degree of coordination and knowledge and integration of the various components required a level of knowledge and a level of intelligence that was beyond anything that I had heretofore, you know, witnessed in my professional life.
How do we know that he didn't remote view?
It's a wonderful question. And the answer is, it sounds in some respects like remote viewing and remote viewing in the future. The issue with remote viewing is that remote viewing is merely a description of a phenomena. Of course, he'd be remote viewing in his dreams. So he'd be unconsciously remote viewing. But remote viewing is not an explanation. It's merely a description of a phenomena. It's trying to understand how all that information could be remote viewed and how it was being revealed that suggested that there was some sort of knowledge and integration of that knowledge that went beyond just, reading some sort of a, if you would, Akashic record in the future. Because it gets back to your point of that it implied that there was some sort of destiny or plan or guidance in the system.
When I look out at the universe, Gary, I see order. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's all over the place. That tells me right there that there's something else going on.
Yes. In fact, one of the things, and a number of books have been written about this, and I mentioned this somewhat briefly in the book because then I deal with the question of where could that order have come from. What physicists have discovered is that there's too much order to have simply occurred by chance. In fact, wherever you look, you see order. I'll never forget, and again, this was first, it was really was discovered or at least made public in the 1980s when I was first pondering this stuff when I was at Yale, where they were not only seeing that if not only were we discovering all these galaxies and these galaxies were having common structures, but then there were what they called superclusters of galaxies, which meant that even the patterns of the galaxies were non-random. That from the micro to the macro, wherever we looked, there was order. And the question is, if the universe was just occurring by some random collection of events, how could you have so much order? There was too much order to explain as being due to chance.
What would Einstein have said about some of this?
Einstein was in fact, I'm just finishing reading one of the latest biographies of Einstein, and he was known for having said this phrase, God does not play dice with the universe, because he, like you, had this sense that there was too much order, and there was too much, in his case, also beauty, to explain this as being due to a random set of events. One of the reasons why Einstein never accepted quantum physics in terms of its theory was that quantum physics makes an assumption which he thought was false reasoning, and the assumption is that the universe is probabilistic, and that when, for example, an electron, what's called the collapse of the wave function, where the probability of it be as the wave appearing as a particle pops into existence, that the process by which that occurs has a fundamental random or chance element to it. And Einstein was convinced that even though on the surface it looked like that conclusion was wrong. And what happened was, which is actually what started me on the journey, was that I had a set of experiences which led me to realize that Einstein's reasoning was actually correct, and you could even prove it.
Einstein's reasoning was correct, and by trying to prove it, yet not a lot of people tried to prove it at that time.
Absolutely. And I probably wouldn't have been led to do that myself if I hadn't had certain experiences. Let me give you an example of one.
All right.
When I was at Yale, actually, I collected sand paintings from the Southwest. And sand paintings, as you probably know, are typically made by Native Americans. The real ones are made by shamans, and they're not permanent because they're placed in the desert and they rapidly blow away by the wind and so on. And they, in order to create these intricate patterns, you have to have an artist who has an image and then carefully places this pattern. And I collected these paintings. And there was an assumption that we are typically taught, which is that there is a probability that you can get a sand painting by chance, because you can always calculate what the probability is. Even if it's improbable, it can happen by chance.
A long shot, but it could happen.
That's what the logic is. Now, remember, I took, well, you wouldn't know this, but I was trained in advanced statistics, you know, as a PhD psychologist. And so I was trained in how to calculate probability and so on. The question was not, was that theory correct? The question was whether nature actually operated by the way they thought the theory operated. And what happened is that no one had actually ever done the experiment. And so I started doing the following experiment and then came to the reasoning about where the flaw, and I do think that this is a fundamental false assumption that most of my scientific colleagues still make. And so imagine the following. As a metaphor, I called it the God box, but you can call whatever you wish. Here's what you do. You take white sand, okay, you put it in a pan or a box, and then you carefully drop black pieces of sand on top. We could draw a square or a cross or a star, or we could draw a heart or a brain.
By dropping them.
We could drop the word God or drop the word dog. It doesn't matter. You put some pattern on there, okay? Then what you do is you cover the box or the pot, and if you have a glass cover or a plastic cover, it's even easier to see. What you do is you shake the box, and then you open it, and you see what happens. Then you shake it again, and you open it and see what happens. Now, here's the question. Does the cross turn into a star? Or does the heart turn into a brain? Or does dog turn into God? What happens to the sand? And we'll come back to that, I think, in the next part.
More to come with Dr. Gary Schwartz. Last hour, we'll take your phone calls, your belief system, that things just don't happen by chance. The G.O.D. Experiments, How Science is Discovering God and Everything Including Us, with Dr. Gary Schwartz. We'll be back with him in a moment. By the way, I should say that William Simon is his co-author, his partner in the book, too. And I give him credit where credit is due. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Gary Schwartz. Gary, I'm curious to see where you're headed with this shifting of the sand story. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. Well, you see, most of us might assume that give it enough time, if you shake the sand, you'll get a new order, right? Dog will turn to God, or you'll get a square or whatever. But that's not what happens if you do the experiment. What happens when you do the experiment is that what the sand does is it mixes. And the more you shake it, the more the black distributes more or less equally with the white. And therefore, you never, it's not like if you wait a long enough period of time, the sand will reconnect and create a new order. What it does, as I said, is it mixes. And there's a huge take-home message in this, by the way, just, and that is that in the absence of some sort of an organizing process, some sort of ordering, you know, set of forces, intelligence, or whatever, what nature does with energetic systems is it brings them together. And that's not a random process. That's 100% replicable. And if you think about it, if sand paintings could occur by chance, you know, people would spontaneously come upon sand paintings on beaches, because beaches have been mixing sand for thousands of years. And I remember when I first realized this, I started doing polls to ask people if they've ever, you know, come upon a sand painting or ever seen pictures of spontaneous sand paintings, I mean, of a sophisticated sort. And the truth is it never happens. So here's the take-home message. If you're walking along a beach, for example, and you come upon this very elegant organization of sand, multicolored sand in the shape of a yay figure or any complex thing or a frog. It doesn't matter what it is. And you ask the question, what's the probability that it could have occurred by chance versus some sort of planning, designing, organizing system putting it there? The probability of it actually occurring as being some sort of a designing process is 100%. And that message is a huge one.
Well, let me ask you, here's an example.
Sure.
Richard C. Hoagland sees a face on Mars. So do some other people.
Mm-hmm.
Is that chance, or is there design there?
Well, this is a very good question, because the question is how much pattern or organization has to be present before you decide that it is it's a non-random pattern,
right.
And that is, of course, that's a statistical question, and that's why with the face on Mars thing, they've done some fairly elaborate statistics to see whether or not it's sufficiently improbable that it could have occurred, quote, by chance. The more detail that's present, of course, the more improbable that it will be the case. But you see, what we have to remember is that even when we approach this way, we're making some assumptions that are wrong. And let me give you one of the reasoning that I came to, which is why I came to the conclusion that Einstein was correct, that God doesn't play dice with the universe. And here's why. In order to get what we call a random distribution, let me be technical for just a couple of minutes. In order to get random distributions of events, two things must be the case. Number one, each event must be independent of every other event. And number two, the object can't change or learn over time. And if you create in abstract mathematics where each event is independent of every other event and where there's no change from event to event, if you do the calculations, you'll get distributions that look like what are called bell-shaped curves. You know, there's a distribution of a point where the mean is and it falls out on the other side. And you get that distribution, and I'll never forget when I actually tested this, you'll get that distribution 100% of the time. The distribution is in fact a repeatable pattern. Now, here's the critical question. To what extent does nature fit the conditions for producing that? Well, here's what physics tells us. Number one, first of all, things are not independent. Everything is connected to everything else. We even learned that from Newton. You know, Newton said that every object that has mass has a gravitational pull. It pulls in all directions. That pull is pulling on every other object. And so even with gravity alone, there's no independence. And then we learned about magnetic fields and so on and so forth. And so what happens is no object is independent of any other object. That's fact number one from physics. Fact number two is that when things create systems, when they have what are called feedback loops, when A affects B and B affects A and they influence each other, which is what happens when we have computer programs with recurrent feedback loops, what happens is you get a growth over time. That's how fractals are formed. Fractals are formed because the information keeps being added or subtracted from the system in particular ways. So and that's the way nature is. Everything's connected to everything else, and things are sharing information and energy. Well, if that's the way nature is, then the conditions to create a random order mathematically don't exist in the first place. And if they don't exist in the first place, you can't even use the theory and mathematics of randomness to apply it to this case. You see what I'm saying? So what happens is when you understand how randomness works, and then you understand how physics and systems work, your logic leads you to the conclusion that there cannot be randomness. What there can be is such complexity that we don't see the patterns. Such complexity that we don't see the patterns. One little story. I'm sure your listeners are aware of what the numbers like pi, right?
Right. 3.14.
No. And they've calculated this out to billions of digits. And they've never been able to find a pattern. Never been able to see a recurrent theme that they could describe mathematically to predict what's going to happen. Okay? Based on that fact, people have come to the conclusion, well, it must be random. It must be random because you can't see a pattern. But the fallacy in that argument is every time you calculate pi, you get the same sequence of numbers. It's completely 100% replicable that this particular sequence of numbers occurs. So how could something be 100% replicable and simultaneously be random? That's inconsistent logic. So rather than concluding that the sequence is random, the alternative conclusion is there's a level of complexity in the unfolding of the order such that we don't know how to describe the pattern. What that does is it puts humility back into the role of being a scientist. And that's a very humbling, you know, place to be. So imagine for the moment if you were in my shoes and you're at Yale and you're pondering systems theory and quantum physics and probability and non-randomness and interconnection, and then you actually do experiments like the sand experiment, and you find, sure enough, the sand doesn't act like random numbers that are independent. It functions in a highly predictable fashion.
How can we use this then, Gary? Let's spend the rest of the program to teach people how we can use this. We are assuming, you and I and so many other people, that there is no randomness, that there is a reason for everything. It's by design. How do we tap into it to use it for our own benefit?
That's wonderful. Well, here's one of the things that I, again, stumbled upon at Yale, and I tell some really beautiful, I consider them, they were very moving experiences for me, I confess, that one of the implications about this is that if this complex creative intelligence exists in everything, including us, remember, we're part of all this, then if we go inside ourselves and then seek to ask questions of this, we attempt to connect with, I call it it, IT for infinite teacher, okay, this universal intelligence, whatever word you want to use, that theoretically we should be able to tap into this intelligence and literally through, quote, intuition, we should be able to receive guidance that will be of the kind of nature that will not only help us connect with the flow, the ebb and flow of these non-random patterns, but moreover, which gets back to your point, for example, about evil, that we have the capability of actually being more in concert, in harmony with this higher intelligence, and then live our lives in a more both healthy, effective, and loving fashion. And what's interesting is that from my point of view, because I'm an agnostic about everything until I give given evidence, if I'm going to ask the universe a question, I have to get, quote, answers that I can then verify as real, you see, because for me it's all ultimately data-based.
Sure.
And in the book, you know, I talk about asking the universe questions. I give examples where I've actually asked the universe questions and then received surprise answers, which forced me to the conclusion that I was tapping into intelligence that I just had to be willing to seek, you know, with humility. And by the way, the notion that we all have an intuitive capability, that we all have the capacity to seek and receive information, this prediction comes directly out of integrating contemporary systems theory and quantum physics. You put those two things together, and it leads you right to the idea of doing this. And if we, therefore, learn how to meditate, how to quiet our minds, how to ask for guidance for the best and highest good, people will be very surprised about the kinds of feelings and information that they can receive that will help them connect with the larger universe.
Have you ever gotten to a point where you wanted to accomplish something, you went to sleep thinking of it, concentrating on it, and you woke up and it was accomplished somehow? That ever happened for you?
Well, it depends upon what you mean by accomplished. I would say that if I was seeking an answer to a problem or to a decision that needed to be made, which turned out to be useful, the answer is yes, that has happened. I've never, tried to imagine getting my car fixed and then waking up in the morning and have it be fixed. But have you actually had such experiences?
Yeah, all the time.
Could you give us an example?
All the time. Well, one of them was doing this program finally, Gary. I mean, it was back in 1996 that I was driving into work doing a fill-in late-night talk show. Fill-in late-night talk show in St. Louis. This was before I ended up doing my Nighthawk show. And I heard Art Bell, and he was interviewing Vince DiPietro, who was one of those who had his theory of the face on Mars. And I was just mesmerized by it. I had heard of Art, but I really, never stepped that late before, and I didn't spend a lot of time listening to him. But this time, I was coming into work. I had to be on the air at 3 in the morning, and so I came in early, and I listened to him. I listened to most of his program, and I was mesmerized by it. That was 1996. I kind of tucked it away.
Mm-hmm.
Jump ahead to maybe the year 2000, late 2000. I heard him again, and I said, you know what? This is the kind of radio show I want to do. By that time, I was doing my own full-time radio show. And I said, how do I get this done? How do I accomplish this? I mean, how do you get a network to realize who you are when you're in a market, you're in St. Louis, and your numbers are good, your ratings are perfect, but how do you get them to notice you? Mm-hmm. And my goal was to fill in. And, lo and behold, I just started thinking about it, and within a week and a half, we had a guy on our St. Louis station who lived in Seattle, but he would come in via ISDN lines, like I do when I'm broadcasting out of my cave in St. Louis, unlike when I'm in Los Angeles. When I'm in L.A., I'm in that studio. When I'm in St. Louis, I'm in a studio cave, but I'm physically not there. I mean, they're all hooked up with me, okay?
Right.
So he was hooked up in Seattle, but he was on our air 2 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, he calls me up one day and said, you've heard of Coast to Coast, right, Art Bell? And I said, yeah, I sure have. And he said, well, I'm the new host. And I went, what? And he went, yeah, Art's retiring, and they just picked me. His name was Mike Siegel. And I said, Mike, this is incredible. Now, you're thinking about doing the show. Look how close it gets. And so I said, Mike, if you ever need me to fill in for you, just let me know. And, he mentioned me to a couple people at the network. And then Mike's tenure didn't last, and Art came back. And within a week or so, the network called me up, and they said, Mike Siegel had given us your tape, and we had heard about you. And we'd like you to do a weekend show for us, just to fill in. And that was in April of 2001. And, the rest for me is history. But every night, Gary, before I went to bed, every night I concentrated on working on this show. And to me, the only rational explanation is that when you put it out there, it works. You got to be ready for it.
Right.
If I wanted to be the world's greatest banker, you got to be trained in banking.
Right.
But, it's going to happen to you. And that's what happened. Isn't that incredible?
It is incredible. And also what I think that for me, which I suspect that you probably agree with, is that it's a co-creation process between us and the larger universe. So there are things that we can do and the things that we can't do. We just can't do, quote, anything that we want. But there are some things that we can do. But those things that we can do, it's up to us to, quote, step up to the plate. And that includes putting out our intention, making requests of the universe, and so on. And the more that we become in sync with and in harmony with this larger intelligence, it is going to contribute to our success. But it's not like we're completely in control. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, except I'll take it a step further. I think we can do anything we set our minds to do. I mean, it's the negativity, it's the doubt, it's the walking on the nails when you realize you're going to get your feet pierced. It's not going to happen for you. So, you know, Gary, I think if you wanted to be the world's greatest author, the world's greatest psychiatrist, if I wanted to be the world's greatest talk show host, if you concentrate on it, if you believe it, it's going to happen for you. It doesn't happen when you have this negativity. We'll be back with more. I want to pick up on this when we come back. Gary, let's get your reaction to my analogy that you could do anything you want if you set your mind to it, if you believe it, and if you tap into that force that's out there. It's when you think, I can't do it, I won't do it, it won't happen, it won't happen.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question that I'd like you to ponder, and also for your listeners to ponder. And that is, if everything is connected to everything else to various degrees, and if there is some sort of higher intelligence which is playing a behind-the-scenes and mostly invisible role in terms of keeping everything more or less interconnected and also semi-synchronized and on some sort of evolutionary path, then is it possible that the kinds of things that we put our mind to, that we resonate with, that we choose to wish, that those choices to wish are actually, if you would, nudged by this higher intelligence? So it's not so much that anything that we could wish we could have, but rather that the wishes that we end up having, we can potentially have because they're actually being encouraged by the invisible force. In other words, it has to do with our idea about whether we have complete freedom to even have a wish independently of everything else, or whether we're part of this larger matrix or network of influence. And of course, I'm forced by both the data that I've collected and the integration of the various fields of physics and system science, I'm forced to entertain that if nothing is random and that there's more complexity to things going on, that includes the fact that even our, quote, spontaneous thoughts are not really spontaneous. It doesn't mean that we don't have some free choice, but that we don't have complete free choice. So your experience that we can have whatever we want may be actually a reflection of the fact that the things that we even choose are partly somewhat guided by this higher intelligence. And I'm just putting this out as a possibility.
You have one of the fascinating chapters in the book where you talk about who are we and why are we here? A question and a series of questions that so many of us ask ourselves, Gary, maybe every day, and still can't come up with the answers.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for raising that that question. One of the things that I tried to do in this book was to ask a lot of those kinds of questions in light of, you know, now what we're learning about the idea of this underlying invisible flow to our lives. Is there any particular question within that chapter that you think the audience would be particularly interested in?
Yeah. Why are we here? I'd like to hear Gary Schwartz's answer on that.
Wow. Okay.
And there may not be an answer.
Right. No.
I understand that.
Right. Well, one of the things that's really extraordinary, and we could even get back to even ask an even deeper question, is why is anything here, let alone why are we here? In other words, if everything is really consciousness, and if everything is consciousness, which then gets turned into energy, and then energy is what crystallizes into matter, if that's the way the universe really works, why are we ever, why do we ever spend time in a material form? And why is it that we
this is the experience that we do? I think the material form is the lessons learned.
Yes, and that's one of the notions is that this is just a great learning laboratory, and that what we're here to do is to learn quote higher lessons. But one of the things that's also really interesting is that we don't normally think of this as that one of the most remarkable creations of an infinite intelligence is actually the invention of matter. In fact, the whole notion about inventing colors or inventing patterns of structures in material form when before there was no material, what happens is you actually begin to think that this is not just, a training station for what you do when you go back to the purely spiritual, but actually it's a manifestation of the continued creativity of consciousness. And therefore, the whole notion of something to try to get through as quickly as you can so you can go on to the next life. But there's something really important about the capacity to manifest caring intelligence within the constraints of physical form. It's, so to speak, a grand experiment on the part of the infinite creator. And now, what that does for me personally is it makes me stand more in awe of the material world. In fact, I was just talking with my significant other during the break about here I am sitting in a living room in our home in Tucson, Arizona, in the foothills near the mountains, and I'm talking on an old landline because I use portable phones all the time, and there's this little cable, a little wire, which I plugged into the wall. I don't normally use this phone. It's actually about maybe 30 feet long because it's going from my study into the living room. And this little wire is carrying frequencies from my voice, which are ultimately going by wires somewhere out there. It's ultimately reaching you. Where are you now, in L.A. or St. Louis? Or
I'm in St. Louis right now, but I go back and forth.
Right at this moment, you're physically located in St. Louis. Yep. I'm physically located in Tucson. But what's happening is our voices going back and forth are now being transmitted all over the whole country right now.
All over the world, actually.
Okay. All over the world. So think about the fact that my voice couldn't get there without going through those little wires. And it's going from these little wires to all over the world. Now, if you think about this, the fact that the universe could be constructed in such a way that it would be physically possible to transform our little voices into these invisible signals that would be traveling all over the world simultaneously, for us not to stand in awe of that capability in the physical form is to miss the magic of the nature of the physical world. And what I'm trying to share with you is that I celebrate our physical existence as a remarkable creation of a consciousness.
Have you seen some of these pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope when it was functioning? And I'm telling you, it looks like the universe itself is alive within all of this.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the very first book that I wrote for the general audience, as opposed to academic books, was a book called The Living Energy Universe. And when that book was published in 1999, it was the first time I was on Coast to Coast. It was with Art Bell. And what was interesting about that particular book was that book was about an analysis from systems theory about how everything that has feedback literally becomes alive, that everything that has circulating information and energy not only has memory, but that memory grows over time. And what's amazing about all of this is that every level in the universe, from the micro to the macro, to the super macro, you've got this constant, continuous circulation of information and energy. You know what that leads to? The prediction that everything at the universe at every single level is alive, it is unfolding, it has memory, and it's all interconnected. So the universe, in fact, I have this quote from, it's funny that you mentioned Sam's, because the quote is attributed to someone called Sam, is that I have this quote about this image of experience of stepping outside the entire universe, if you could imagine that, and seeing it slowly but surely transforming from what looked like a whole, you know, an infinite number of caterpillars, so to speak, into a gigantic rainbow-colored butterfly universe of indescribable beauty. Now, could you imagine if the whole universe was actually going through a transformation even of its own order?
Yes.
I know you could.
And I think it's happening.
And it may be continually happening.
Yes.
And you know what amazes me even more? That we little beings on this little planet can conceptualize all of this. I have this whole chapter in this book about the God Experiments book about the power of the human mind, that our mind is literally bigger than the entire universe because we can actually conceive of it that way. And that's just, to me, awesome.
Have you ever just walked down a busy street? Especially, you know, if you're in New York, this is a perfect example. And you're looking at thousands of people, and each one of them, Gary, is thinking about their own lives, their families, their problems, their good times, every one of them. And when you look at all of them, it is truly amazing. It's remarkable that each individual is a functionary part of this whole thing. It really is.
It absolutely is. By the way, I find it very thrilling to know that you have those kinds of thoughts, George. And forgive me for being so complimentary. But it's not every day that I bump into people whose minds are broad enough and playful enough to ponder that kind of consciousness. Because I've had that experience too, walking in Manhattan in particular, because there's so many people. And realizing that there's all of these stories, there's all these individual consciousnesses, all going on in parallel at the same time. And that all of this is occurring, and it's occurring all over the world, let alone, you know, beyond our particular planet.
You know, it hit me again today when, in the first hour, Gary, before you came on, I had the story of the poor chap who went crab hunting in Australia and got eaten, apparently, by an alligator. And for one split second, I am trying to put myself in his body, to put myself in his brain, imagining myself crab hunting. And he's got his pots out there, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, some alligator comes and attacks you and grabs you. Can you imagine the moment that this happened to that poor guy? What he must have been going through? It's amazing.
It is amazing. It is amazing. And you know what's also amazing? That we have the capacity to imagine all of this.
Yeah.
You know, our capacity to imagine. One of the things that, by the way, in the tail end of the book, I talk about, I have a chapter called Infinite Love, the Ultimate Gift from God. And one of the things that I realized, actually initially when I was more like a young child, but it really came back to me in the process of writing this book, is that we human beings, and again, it's also something I don't think we fully appreciate, we have this capacity to literally love anything and everything. We have the capacity to love plants and animals and foods and sports and artwork and inventions and ideas and so on. And as little children, you know, we're like little love machines. You know, everything's an adventure. Everything's to be explored. Everything initially goes into the mouth. One of the things that absolutely amazes me, particularly if you live in a university system, I mean professionally, which is what I do, is that you have thousands of faculty at a given university, each of whom have a passion for some particular thing. It may be molecules, or it may be atoms, or it may be forces, or it may be planets, or it may be diseases, or it may be, you know, sociological issues and philosophical questions, dance, art. You've got all these people, each of whom have a passion for a particular thing. And what kind of being has the capacity to love so many different kinds of things? Exactly. It's almost as if the universe has designed us to make sure that nothing is left unloved. Nothing is left unexplored. And it's really important, by the way, that we don't share the same passions. Because this way it becomes possible for us to be able to be connected to, you know, virtually all of this. And again, we have this, it's like our minds are a reflection of this potential intelligence. And we ourselves are not aware of the great power that lies within us.
Truly amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it makes for an interesting life.
Well, it does. First of all, where did we get your book? Because mainstream media is not jumping all over it, and they should.
No, the book is available, of course, from Amazon or Barnes & Noble and, you know, any of the sort of major booksellers. It's now available in paperback, it was a great privilege to write it and have the assistance of my writing partner in doing so, and I think it's certainly worth thinking about.
Absolutely. And well, next hour we'll take phone calls from everyone based on questions for you. And I'd like them to relate some of their own observations of the fact that, you know, nothing happens by chance.
Right. In fact, one of the things I hope is that people will share some of the, you know, remarkable synchronicity stories that have in their lives. I'm currently working on a new book on on synchronicities, which I embedded in the last chapter in which you started just 2 hours ago, because it turns out that one of the ways that we know that there's more going on is because we experience patterns of synchronicities in our lives. In my case, the very first one that I had, which started me on this journey, was when I was at Yale, and I began to notice the ridiculous improbability of the number 11 showing up in my life. So, for example, my office was room 1A, and of course, A is the first letter of the alphabet. So that was 11, and the office was on it was next to Kirkland Avenue, and it's spelled Kirkland AVE, which of course had 11 letters. I had to take Route 1A to go home, which gives us a hit 11. I lived at Route 326, which added up to 11. I lived in the state of Connecticut, which had 11 letters. My phone number added up to 11. My license plate, when you took the letters and added them up, you know, gave them the numbers in the alphabet and added up to 11 and so on. They were like, I can't remember, 11 or 12, you know, no pun intended about the number 11 there, improbable numbers. And I couldn't make any sense of it because I knew that it was statistically improbable. And then I had this weird occurrence where a young black medical student came to see me wanting to do his dissertation. Yeah, a medical student had to do a not a PhD dissertation, but still some independent research. He wanted to do research on the integration of quantum physics, acupuncture, and ancient black philosophy. And I told him I knew a fair amount about quantum physics. I knew next to nothing about acupuncture, and I knew absolutely nothing about black philosophy. And anyway, he led me on a path, which we can talk about later, to realize that our lives are very interconnected.
And we will take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Gary Schwartz. We're going to take your phone calls. Gary, there are some implications of what you consider to be the guiding, organizing, designing process. Let's talk a little bit about that before calls. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, one of the things is that to the extent that evolution in general is intelligent and it's creative, it's not just a random process, then to the extent that we can come to know this process, we can learn to move in harmony with it. And, of course, that's a huge statement. But in our own personal lives or in our business lives, it means that we can make moment-to-moment choices which allow us to be ever more connected with the larger universe of which we're a part. And those principles actually awaken, if you would, a feeling of wonder and enjoyment back into life. Because, for example, if as a result of, if you would, tuning in and allowing one's intuitions to unfold with this kind of guidance, and therefore you become aware of more patterns and more synchronicity and more connection in your life, it makes life much more interesting. You get to have a sense of hope. You take a longer view. It increases your sense of gratitude and adventure and appreciation. There's just a lot of positive. In fact, now that I'm, you know, as I'm talking about this out loud, I can't really think of any negative consequence of becoming more in harmony with the this kind of a guidance process.
Wow, you've done remarkable work with this. And, you know, even though you worked with William Simon in writing the book, did you do most of the research yourself or did you have some help from other people?
Actually, in this particular work, I would say it was done a good 90% by myself. I mean, there were things involved, various people in the journey, and of course I learned many things. I mean, for example, the work I did with Christopher Robinson. But this was really something where it was very much a personal journey, personal/scientific. And the other thing was is that I wasn't planning to do this work. I mean, I wasn't trained to do this kind of science.
You're an afterlife guy.
I'm also an energy guy, and I was also a psychophysiology guy. But I was not. I never anticipated that if you would, fate would take me to addressing this kind of question.
Well, let's go to the phones. You ready?
Sure, absolutely.
We'll pick it up by going to our first-time caller line, Wolfgang in Hawaii. Welcome to the program, Wolfgang.
Aloha. I'm very excited.
Aloha to you, too.
To meet you guys there, Gary and George. I'm excited about the turn of the show into this realm. And I have been a person, I'm now going to 50. I have had visions all of my life about the universe, and I was never able to really voice it and never really to understand until I really got to feel that in the now lies a tremendous power by letting go of everything that really distracts our mind and, so to speak, to feel that the universe is not just some space that expands, but it is indeed a conscious organism, like the Earth is a conscious organism for me. And I was really wondering whether Gary had this, what is it called, epiphany about really sensing that we are at any given moment really part of a conscious living universe, that that everything that happens to us basically is, does not happen to us. It is happened by us, so to speak, that we, whatever we believe in or whatever we think of, is projected around us. So our eyeballs actually creating the universe around us or the world around us, and we are not seeing it, but we are creating it with our beliefs. And that religion takes, has a really big part of a distraction from all of this, because it makes differences, and differences are actually, I believe, not the universal flow of things. I think there's an interdependence that is so beautiful that everything is connected to everything else. And I really admire Gary's approach to doubt the coincidence of things. And I do believe there is no coincidence. This is everything is really the way it should be. And that was my turn to that.
Okay, Gary, do you want to react to that? And I think he, Wolfgang, said it right on.
Well, first of all, that's a very beautiful experience that you've described, Wolfgang. In fact, before I responded to it, I was wondering if you could share a little bit more about when you started having these experiences and how it began to unfold.
I was very, very sick when I was 3 years of age. I had a bronchial asthma that almost caused me to pass on, and my mom was really sitting for weeks. She was sitting upright in the bed, preventing me from tipping over and going to the horizontal position, because I would have so to speak choked to death, or I would have suffocated to death.
Mm-hmm.
And from that moment on, I had reoccurring dreams for about 15 years in which a dark cloud would come to me, and it would absorb everything. It would take my breath. It would take my sensory system, my vision, and I had to leave the light on, in able to get so exhausted to be able to fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, I really wanted to know, what is that darkness actually that was engulfing me and so to speak clearing me or cleaning me out. And for a brief moment of time, I was able to enter at 4 o'clock in the morning. I would get a tremendous rush in energy, and I would get answers to questions I was not even able to ask those questions, and I would get answers that were so profound, and they were from a consciousness that is so beautiful, and there's only love. And this is so wonderful, and it was explained to me, basically, that the cloud was projected by me because I had some sense of a reoccurring death experience that was fueled by, by my grandma's idea of what life is and how death is happening to us. She was Protestant, and there was basically a vacuum that I had to fill with meaning and with sense, and that meaning and sense became for me the beauty of that perpetual expanding and expanding consciousness. Like you said, the butterfly universe is such a beautiful analogy of it, because it is alive, and to feel it, to be in the now without distraction, enables us to partake in a conscious process that really grabs us and lets us partake then again. And it's like, how do I say? It's an automatic. It's a mechanism that
okay.
A long time in America, but sometimes my German takes the upper hand. But the universe is us. I am the universe. Mm-hmm. We are the universe. You guys are me. I am you guys. We are. This is all one. It's all one consciousness that has a different levels of experience. Like I would say, my body cells. I mean, we have so many body cells. All those cells are conscious about that they are part of me and of the universe.
So you understand it, Wolfgang, and Gary, he does. Let's take a few more calls, but he's tapped into it, and you can tell he's probably done that for a long time.
Exactly, and one of the things that you notice that when people have this universal experience, which they may perceive in their own unique ways, which is also part of the beauty and creativity, the essence, the universality of that huge take-home message comes through. And he seems to have it in spades.
Next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies, Danny in Covina, California. Hey, Danny, go ahead.
Hey, George. I'm glad to talk to you. I wanted to just say, George, I really felt you tonight. And I have a psalm. It's number one. And I think you'll like it because it talks about not being wicked, but being like a tree planted by flowing by rivers of water that bringeth forth his fruit in season. His leaf also shall not wither, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. And I believe that I've taken that from the age of 13, and I've called on the line before, and I just meditate on that since the age of 13, and I'm 27 now.
Good for you.
Yeah. And I believe that the light that I saw at my house, I wanted to be like Einstein and like do things with light. And I started running as fast as I can, and I just believed in this scripture because I believe that it just came into my mind. It just said, read Psalms. And I said, I'm going to believe that. And so I tried running as fast as I can up and down my street at night sometimes and to teleport. And I finally did, and I did teleport twice. And I have a friend whose dad was in the CIA who called it remote viewing, and he was familiar with the project that I was on.
Right.
Yeah, and I just believe that, like what you said, like in the later part of that chapter, it says the wicked will perish, and I just think that if you're evil, you know, I think we're coming to a new age where people will become more aware of things that they can possibly do, and if you don't have that awareness, you're not going to be able to make it. You're not going to be caught up in this consciousness or whatever.
Oh, I think, Danny, what's beginning to happen is people are becoming aware of those who are evil when they probably didn't expect it before. Don't you think, Gary, that's happening?
I think, you know, I would generally have to agree with you about that. I think there's a very deep realization of that as we start becoming more aware of this universal consciousness and also compassion and love. We also then become more aware of when people are not manifesting that. And the contrast becomes ever clearer. We become more discerning. And I think many people are having that experience right now.
Well, let's go to Texas. Bridget, take it away. Hey, Bridget.
Hey, how are y'all?
Good.
This is Bridget from Tomball. And I was telling Tom about an experience that's been happening all my life. I mean, it's like synchronicities to the max.
Oh, share with us.
There's just too many of them. It's just extraordinary. It's in my dreams. It's in my waking life. It's in symbols. It's in signs. It's everywhere. Everywhere I go, it's like God is giving me a message about something. And it's beautiful, you know. And he's revealed things to me in my dreams, and at the time it didn't make sense, but God wanted me to remember those dreams for a reason. Now I know. And it's amazing how things work in order. There's no such thing as coincidences. Everything has a reason.
Yep, you are right on.
And may I allow to share one experience as an example of that?
Sure. Go ahead, real quickly, Bridget.
Okay. Well, last May, there was this show that I like. They're filming it. Well, I haven't had no internet access, okay? Well, I was picturing the main character holding a baby in my head. I'm like, why am I thinking about this? What is going on with this guy holding a baby? And then later on, I found out when I got back online, because I had no knowledge of this whatsoever. It was just in my mind, and I kept seeing this picture continuing over and over again. Until later on, I heard the guy who plays the main character saying that his favorite part during filming of that show was him holding a newborn baby. And my mouth just dropped. And that's just one of the many zillion things that are happening every day. It's just, there's no words to describe it. I mean, I wish I can put it in simple terms, but synchronicities, it's just, there's more to it than what meets the eye.
You know,
it's enlightenment, isn't it, Gary?
Yes, and what happens is when you have that level of connections appearing over and over, it's wondrous. You feel this sense of just, you know, I'll keep using the word magical. It's sort of, it's just words like amazement and startling and wondrous and awe and so on are just, your life just becomes more and more filled with that. And I presume that you really appreciate that you're in the flow, aren't you, Bridget?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Tony in Knoxville, Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Hey, Tony.
Hey, guys. Now, George, I just wanted to say real quick, I've been hooked on you since the last time you had a Nostradamus expert on.
Yes.
I've only been listening about 2 weeks, and I'm absolutely enthralled. Now, the gentleman that you have on, I'm real bad with names. I wanted to tell you something that I thought about when you were talking about your correlation of the number 11 in the universe.
Ah, please.
In my own religion, I'm an Odinist. In the beginning and before the world was created, there were 11 factors to the creation of the world. Now, before this, I was a Catholic, and I was actually planning on going through seminary. And if you look rather closely at the Bible, there's actually 11 commandments.
Really?
Yes. The first one is the one that nobody thinks about is, I give thee these commandments that my children may worship me. That is actually commandment number one. You're good, Joe.
Wow.
Before the other 10 that, you know, are actually on the stone tablets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at all the other religions in the world, you'll find that there's either 11 deities or there are 11 factors to the creation of this plane of existence.
Hmm. Have you been thinking about this history of the significance of 11 for some time? Is that correct?
No, only about 20 minutes.
Only about 20 minutes?
Oh,
that's really funny.
Trust.
You want to hear something? This is really amusing. While I was waiting in the interim, between the one segment and the next, I was realizing that I was called at 11 p.m. my time tonight. I'm talking to George Norrie, who has 11 letters in his name. I was having this insight, and the show came back on at 1:10, which of course is again an 11. And I was saying, gee, I'm having a lot of thoughts about 11 with an 11 at this point, and within, 20 minutes or so, you call having insights about the number 11.
The only thing we failed at.
Including the 11th commandment. What?
We should have had you on November 11th.
Wow, well, thank you for sharing that.
And, Gary, again, the book, The G.O.D. Experiments, available where?
Amazon, Borders, everywhere.
And your website is?
DrGarySchwartz.com.
DrGarySchwartz.com. Exactly. Dr. You do not spell out doctor.
Do not spell out doctor.
And you spell your last name S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z.
Correct.
Right? Okay. You know, we'll be back in just a moment. We'll take final phone calls with Dr. Gary Schwartz, so fire away. I know many of you have been on hold for a long time. Sorry about that. We'll try to get to as many of your calls as we can. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Final segment with our special guest, Dr. Gary Schwartz. Gary, what's next? What other experiments? What's on your plate?
Well, I'm busy working on completing a book focused on synchronicity because of it's, as I said, one of the best ways of discovering patterns and connections in our lives. And when I was writing the acknowledgments to this book, I realized that there were over 80 people who had been part of this, if you would, natural experiment, including physicians and business people and teachers and artists and students and so on, where they would share, in quite surprising ways, multiple synchronicities with me. And this book is chronicles these many examples and shows how we can discover these things in our own lives. And I talk about what I call, quote, self-science, which is the idea about how nobody else can discover our connections with the larger universe except us. It's our responsibility to put the time and energy into looking for these things and finding the patterns. And so that's one of the things that is joyfully consuming my energies.
Well done. Let's go back to the phones. First time caller line, we've got Jason in Indiana. Hey, Jason, thanks for holding.
Hey, George, thanks for having me on. Jerry, it's nice to talk to you.
Hi.
I was listening, through the whole show like I always do, and George had asked, who are we and why are we here? And for some reason, a thought struck my head. It seems to me like we're all just sort of like bookmarks in this whole story of human existence, It seems like, each of us defines our own place, but that we all tend to kind of define the progress of the human race also throughout the course of, everything past, present, and future. It was just sort of kind of a nebulous thought like that, but it just struck me, and I thought I ought to get it out loud there. So.
All right. Very good.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's a very clean way of expressing it.
It was. Sharon in Palm Springs, California. Hey, Sharon, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, what a pleasure to be on online today. I just wanted to share some of my experiences. First of all, I did want to say everyone is absolutely beautiful. I love this subject of God. Anyway, I am a recovering alcoholic of 25 years of sobriety.
Wow, congratulations.
And thank you. And I lived in an alcoholic home, and then I became an alcoholic. And 4 years into my sobriety, I had a horrible, horrible dream. And I'm talking about synchronicities and how God works in our lives. Anyway, I had a horrible dream. And about 2 months after that, I had an out-of-body experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up to the ceiling, and I played with the ceiling. It was wonderful. And then when I came back in body, I was very angry because it was so wonderful to be free.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next step, I did have a white light experience. The light came into my apartment, and it just felt like so much love. I was very afraid at that particular time, but then I realized that I was forgiven and I was loved. And then I was on the island of Kauai, and I had this mirror. I woke up, and this mirror was shining at me, and I saw the head of a jaguar or a lion, and this voice came and said, "I'm God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will take care of you through this next year." And at that time, I'd gone back to my husband, and everything was wonderful, but it was an abusive relationship. 3 months later, I had what you call the Kundalini awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I was just drunk with love from God. And I knew at that particular time, I knew that we were all one. If I hurt you, I hurt myself. I went out and looked at the stars, and this may sound crazy, but to me, the stars and the trees are my brothers and sisters. and it was so overwhelming with the love,
mm-hmm,
that I received. And to me, it's all about love. It really is. And what an experience that was.
And now that you've had that experience, it seems like it's really been a lasting one, that it really defined your life. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. It also has been bittersweet,
mm-hmm,
because of the fact that that many people surrounding me don't understand where I'm coming from, because I give a lot of love out.
Sure.
And And in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, we have in the last step, you know, having had a spiritual awakening, we share this message with others. And sometimes, you know, I don't really tell too many people about this, although I have written a book about it. But
get us a copy, Sharon.
Well, would you like a copy?
Send it to my LA office if you would. I'll be back there in a couple weeks.
Okay, it's called Return of the Child of Light.
Okay, let's do that. I want to take some more final calls. Gary, we've had a lot of people on hold for a while.
Please.
David in Tucson, Arizona, your turn. Go ahead, David.
Oh, there, George. I have something in common with your guest. I live in Tucson, and I have Gary since 1955. And Tucson seems to be a place in the world, one of the places in the world that's a drawing spot where people, if they leave here, they come back, they keep coming back and what have you. But what I wanted to talk about tonight is that I happen to be a sight challenged person.
Mm-hmm.
And because I am sight challenged, I see the universe in a different framework. I don't see it visually. But I do see it in sound and experience.
Oh, how interesting.
And because I see it in the sound and experience realm, I have a tendency to find things more tuned and more in tune with how I think in my mind.
Interesting.
And this is a very interesting thing. I've surrounded myself in my life with things like audio and sound, ham radio, different things that I know that I can achieve in, and I can find the sounds and the things in my world that I'm looking for. And I really appreciate the show tonight there, George. You're doing a good job there, guy. And
thank you, David.
The good work.
We shall do that.
Thank you.
You're doing all the work, though, Gary. I'm just kind of like riding along with you.
We're doing it together.
East of the Rockies, Ted in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Ted.
Hey, well, good morning, guys. What a wonderful subject we're talking about tonight.
It's enlightening. We need that after the couple weeks we've been going through, huh?
Really, it's true. You know, we've been through a lot of ups and downs, and I think we're back on an upswing. I wanted to tell you guys, being in contact with the mass consciousness, at least that's what my wife says about me, I think, you know, we're like transmitters and receivers.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's kind of electrically based. I saw something recently I wanted to share with you guys. This is not my forte. This is not what I do for work. But a message came to me personally, and I'm sure there's somebody out there working on this project right now, and this message is to that individual. And it's about curing cancer, the fountain of youth. This actually will lead into other things. And it's basically to do with magnetism, finding the resonant frequency for that cell that is disturbed or multiplying incorrectly, with inducing the right frequency. There's a tree, and with this tree, there either a branch is out of alignment or there's something that needs to be in alignment by generating this frequency under a controlled condition, like, you know, our atmosphere. If you guys understand, I'm not a scientist, so I'm just going by something that I picked up on. Something like medicine or a chemical injected with this could either replace or put on the tree something that is needed. And this is something that will be the change of medicine forever, if you guys understand what I'm saying.
I do, actually. I wrote a book called The Energy Healing Experiments, and I'm very interested. In fact, we've done research on magnetic fields coming from healers and resonance with magnetic fields and so on. And the fact that you are verbalizing this, and it sounds like this has come to you intuitively, if I understand correctly.
It's
very interesting.
Ted, thank you. Let's take a few more calls. Michelle in Apple Valley, Minnesota. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there, George.
Good to have you with us.
Hello. I just simply would like to relay one of my favorite synchronicity stories.
Sure.
I used to be married to a man from Morocco, and I used to live in Rabat, Morocco in the early 90s. And my second year there, I worked at the Rabat American School. And I happened to cross paths with two other women on the sidewalk one afternoon. And we started talking. And we found out that each of us was a woman from the United States married to a man from Morocco. Each of us had moved from the U.S. to Morocco, and we were employed here at the school for the first time. And all three of us had two-year-old daughters, and they were all named Layla.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that wonderful?
It's totally wonderful.
My favorite synchronicity story, but I'm amazed by synchronicity, and I look for it.
That's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. That's all I to share with you. Thank
Very
you so
good.
Much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Do you distinguish the difference between synchronicity and fate?
Well, that's a very deep question.
Yes.
And you ask deep questions.
I'm throwing them out tonight, huh?
The answer, of course, is that you have to. Synchronicity is merely a description of two or more events which happen concurrently, like the story that we just heard, which implies which are sufficiently non-random and improbable, that they are, it implies that there's some sort of connection and some sort of meaning. Now, some synchronicities may in fact reflect a fate that is, there's actually a Yiddish word called beshert, which means it was meant to be. But this notion that there was some sort of energy or force that had led this to come into existence. And, of course, one of the really deep questions is when is something, quote, fated to happen or destined to happen, and when is it something where we, so to speak, co-create these occurrences by being open to them occurring and sort of being in the right place at the right time. So where it's not so much, it's if you would, semi-fate. It's partially fate, but it's partially our individual choices. And to tell you the truth, that's not a question that I have an answer to yet. That's probably one of those next deep questions, which, by the way, no one's ever asked me before, George, so now you've given me something to think about.
There you go. Let's go to Tom in Delaware. Go ahead, Tom.
How's it going?
Good.
Hello.
My whole perception of life changed like instantly. I can't accept. I guess it was about a year ago. The way that I perceive things, it's like there's only three things that really matter to me, and one is unproven facts.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is we just know that something, we lived on Mars or there's been civilization on Mars. We cannot prove it yet,
mm-hmm.
but it's there. It gives us ambition, it gives us motivation, and it makes us wonder, and it basically keeps us motivated to keep going, if you know what I mean.
Yes, interesting.
If we didn't have unproven facts, there wouldn't be no ambition to live, if you think about it.
Okay.
Just think about that. If we knew everything,
right,
what reason would there be to live?
Right.
It's the things that we know, we just know have to be, but we cannot prove them, that keep us going. And that, and another thing that's built into to me that I believe is survival at all costs. Because even though that I feel that there's, say, another dimension that we go to, because life is eternal, I believe that 100%, that we never die, we just won't take that step as far as, you know, suicide goes. We won't take that chance, even though we just know there's something better out there. It's survival's built into everything at all costs. Yes, there's a few here and there that do, unfortunately, do that. But we don't even know if they made the right move or not, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about it is I look at life completely different now, and it gets frustrating because I feel that we can create our own reality, but we're split so much we just cannot get on the same page in order to achieve this, if you know what I'm saying. Because if we all came together and we wanted something and we concentrated on something as, you know, a whole multitude of people, the population, we could make whatever we want it would be.
Right. You know, it's really interesting, but actually, I've done some research with a woman by the name of Lynn McTaggart, who wrote a book called The Attention Experiment.
And The Field.
And The Field, and right.
And I got one more thing. Deja vu, I believe that we subconsciously and unconsciously experience deja vu a lot more than we actually pick up on. Like, we notice it sometimes, but I believe that subconsciously it happens all the time. And that's also something that motivates us to continue to live, is that just knowing that we did this before and there's got to be something else. And I do believe that we experience that a lot more than we pick up on. And my last thing before I go is...
Tom, real quick, we got to go in 15 seconds.
I believe that there is another dimension, and the reason that we are not allowed to know the secret right now because everything is balanced. If we knew everything right now, then it would upset the universe, and we're not just allowed to know that right now. Everything has a time. Take care.
Gary Schwartz, my friend, thank you so much. Good luck with this latest work. We'll talk to you during the next one, all right?
Thank you. I want to, by the way, you are the first person who has actually wanted to take a long and deep look at this work, the God Experiment. So I want to thank you so much for this.
You deserve
it. It sounds like your audience appreciated our conversation tonight.
Good luck with this work.
Thank you.
For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.